From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Madeline Brand. Coming up, the CEOs of the big three automakers return to Washington looking for a bailout. In the meantime, car dealerships struggle to stay open.
First, though, today President-elect Barack Obama held another press conference in his hometown of Chicago, Illinois. He formally announced a nomination that's been talked about for some time now. He's chosen Senator Hillary Clinton to be the next Secretary of State.
I assembled this team because I'm a strong believer in strong personalities and strong opinions. I think that's how the best decisions are made. One of the dangers in a White House, based on my reading of history, is that you get wrapped up in groupthink and everybody agrees with everything and there's no discussion and there are no dissenting views. So I'm going to be welcoming a vigorous debate inside the White House. But understand, I will be setting policy as president.
Joining us now from Chicago is NPR's Don Gagne. Don, during the primaries, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama had some pretty tough words for one another. Did Mr. Obama make any reference to that today?
Well, he was asked specifically about statements he made about Senator Clinton during the tough campaign, where she would point to her time as first lady as, in effect, being foreign policy experience. And during the campaign, he belittled that. And at one point during the campaign, her time traveling while her husband was in the White House was described as, you know, little more than attending teas. President-elect Obama was asked specifically about those comments today. He laughed. He said, hey, the press likes to have fun digging up old quotes, to which Peter Baker of the New York Times responded, well, sir, those are your quotes. And he said, yes, and you're having fun with it. He said, it's not that it's not fair to do it, but he said he and Senator Clinton are clearly on the same page in terms of what America's posture and position in the world needs to be.
Hillary Clinton also spoke at this press conference. What did she have to say?
She said she was deeply honored for this job that she has been nominated for. She also gave a farewell to New York, thanking New York for sending her to the United States Senate. She talked about how serving New York is great preparation to be Secretary of State. She said New Yorkers are not afraid to speak their mind, and they do it loud, and they do it in every language. So that got a pretty good laugh from everybody up on the stage.
Don, what other announcements came out of today's press briefing?
Well, we have retired General James Jones to be the National Security Advisor. His family, he pointed out, has served in the military going back to 1939, so generation after generation. A lot of these announcements today, we knew were coming. Eric Holder will be the first African-American United States Attorney General. Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano will be Department of Homeland Security. Robert Gates, the current Defense Secretary, will stay on in that job. At one point, President-elect Obama was asked if that qualifies as his now having a Republican in his cabinet. He said he didn't check Mr. Gates' voter registration, but again, he feels he is an important voice to have on his team.
NPR's Don Gagne speaking to us from Chicago, Illinois. Thanks, Don.
My pleasure.
And now for some analysis with NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. And Ron, let's pick up where Don left off and talk about Robert Gates over at the Pentagon and James Jones as National Security Advisor. What did these two men, their appointment, what does that say to the rest of the world about President-elect Barack Obama's foreign policy priorities?
It tells the rest of the world, and it tells Americans as well, that his primary concern is for continuity and that he wants to have the security that comes out of the Bush years without some of the policies of the Bush years that he believes have actually reduced our national security. And that, of course, includes the war in Iraq.
And James Jones, I think, has been especially critical that he has been quoted as saying we took our eye off the ball and that the real action we need to focus on is in Afghanistan.
There have always been people at the highest levels of the American military establishment, uniform and civilian, who have felt that the emphasis on Iraq starting in the first Bush term was in error and that we should have stayed focused on Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and some of our relationship with Pakistan. And I think a lot of the events of just the last few days and certainly the last several years have borne out that point of view, and it has now risen to power in the person of James Jones to be the National Security Advisor.
And does he share the same philosophy with Senator Clinton?
I think Senator Clinton is prepared to carry forward into her service as Secretary of State the change of heart that she underwent in the last several years regarding the war in Iraq. She was for it in the first place. She saw it as necessary in the wake of 9/11. She was, after all, the senator from New York. And she was, I think, in fairness, we can say, anticipating running for president at some future date against a Republican who would try to make her seem relatively a lightweight on national security. She has seen it all in a different light, of course, and in running for president in 2008, while she did not ever say she had made a mistake and she never really repudiated her vote for the war, she did make it clear that she had changed her mind about it. So I think that she is in harmony with the general thinking of the other members of the national security and foreign policy team here, including, of course, the president-elect himself.
Although the president-elect did say that there would be disagreements when it came to how to approach his foreign policy objectives. He doesn't seem to be shying away from that. Where are some of those disagreements?
There could be disagreements with respect to how we deal with foreign leaders who are particularly of a mind to give the United States fits. Let us say Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran, for example. Other foreign leaders, perhaps, who might emerge in Pakistan, who might emerge in other countries who are not in power there now, possibly also including Iraq. Barack Obama has said we should sit down and we should talk to those people without the kind of preconditions that the Bush administration set, which were essentially you must dismantle your own policies that we object to before we will negotiate with you. That could be a point of disagreement because Hillary Clinton in the past has belittled that as either naive or as being misguided.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. Has she come around and will she now follow the president-elect's goals in that arena?
Whether she has come around to his point of view entirely or not, she will follow his goals in that area because that will be her job. There's a great potential here with Joe Biden as vice president and with the strong personality of Hillary Clinton and some of these other personalities who are involved. There is the possibility that there will be a great deal of clash. And you heard in the press conference Barack Obama addressing that issue and saying that he didn't bring them together to be an echo chamber, that they were not intended to be groupthink, to use his word. But in the end, it will be the test will be whether the president has the strength of personality and will to impose his own view on his team, whatever their rivalrous or whatever their disagreeing points of view.
And I assume there won't be any big road bumps to Hillary Clinton's confirmation in the Senate, right?
Nothing that would really prevent her from being confirmed and overwhelmingly confirmed. I think where she might actually get a little more flack is not from the Republicans, but from some of the Democrats on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I'm thinking of Russell Feingold here, possibly Jim Webb, the senator from Virginia. These are people who have opposed the war from the very beginning and who have not been shy about pointing out that they were against the war right from the beginning. And they might want to have a little session with her to see how she may have changed her thinking about it.
NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Tomorrow, car sales numbers for November are due out, and they're not expected to be good. That could lead to more dealerships shutting down, and that could mean a big loss of revenue for local governments. For example, this year, the state of California has lost at least $2 billion in sales taxes due to the drop in car sales. To get a better sense of how local governments are coping, we're joined now by Marshall Bond. He's the city manager from Monroeville, Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us, and why don't you tell us how many car dealerships are in Monroeville?
Just about every major domestic and foreign manufacturer sells cars here in Monroeville.
And so how much of your budget comes from the revenue from car sales at these dealerships?
We have a business tax, which obviously is, I'd say, probably of that. I'd say total tax is probably about 15% to 20% is based upon our related car industry.
So that's a fair chunk of change.
It is, yeah.
How are the dealerships there faring? How are their sales going?
It's a little hard to tell because, of course, our figures are based on last year's activity. You know, while I don't think it's as bleak as other areas of the country, I don't see as much activity as I'm sure that most of them would like to see. So it's a little bit destitute, for lack of a better term, than we'd like to see.
So how are you going to deal with that? Are you going to need to make cuts to your budget?
Well, we're going to have to take a close look and see what the outfall is. I mean, we're like everybody else. I mean, government, even local government, tends to lag a little bit behind business and some of the larger governments, but it'll all filter down, and it's either going to be other types of taxes, which certainly elected officials don't like to impose, or it's going to be cuts. And if I had a bet, it would be the latter.
And is there fat to trim in your budget?
That depends on who you talk to, of course. You know, some of our police and fire and public works folks have gone through some tough times so far, but we as a government, I think, have to reflect what's going on to the people we serve. And, you know, if they're having to do with a lot less and, you know, make some significant cuts in muscle as opposed to non-muscle, we're going to have to do the same ourselves.
In addition to helping out local government, auto dealerships often fund local charities, sports teams, things like that. Have you seen any fallout there in Monroeville?
Not yet, but I know that it can only reflect what the economy is reflecting. And fortunately or unfortunately, some of those cuts are the easiest to make because they are somewhat discretionary. And, you know, so I just anticipate it only being a matter of time before, you know, those type charities, as you would, are impacted.
Obviously, it's in your best interest to have these car dealerships fare well. So is there anything that you as a city manager have been doing to try to help them out, to keep them open?
Well, actually, there is. I mean, our council has granted a sort of a 20% reduction for this year on business taxes. And, you know, we're having to tighten our belt a little bit to deal with that in the hope that, you know, that does relieve some of the stress. It sort of demonstrates that, you know, we are doing our own little version of an economic stimulus package because it affects all retail sales in the community. But, you know, we're going to have to deal with getting less revenue at a time where that's going to be very, very difficult. But something that we felt we have to take a leadership role in, and we can't print money, but we can reduce.
Marshall Bond is the city manager in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. Thank you and best of luck.
Thank you.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Let's pick up where we left off. It was the week before Thanksgiving. The CEOs of the big three automakers were sent back to Detroit with nothing. This week, they're back in Washington with a new plan, and presumably it's a lot more detailed about what they'll do in exchange for billions of taxpayer dollars. With us now is Detroit Free Press correspondent Justin Hyde. And Justin, what have these CEOs of Ford, Chrysler, and GM, what have they been doing in the last 2 weeks?
Well, Madeline, in the past 2 weeks, they've been poring over ideas and plans to bring back to Congress in hopes of convincing enough lawmakers that they need up to $25 billion in loans to get through the next several months.
And do we have any word at all what those plans may be, what kind of cuts we're expecting?
We don't have specifics on the plan as of yet, but we know some of the general directions that they'll have to go in. For example, with GM, we've heard that they're considering cutting up to 4 brands out of the 8 that they sell in the United States. They're likely going to ask their debt holders to help them work on reducing their debt. Basically, they're going to have to look all across their businesses to find enough cuts to convince Congress that they're serious about remaking their business in order to get this money that they're seeking.
And there's also been some talk that they need to present plans to come up with cars that are more energy efficient, that are more forward-looking.
That's true. And it's been interesting because each automaker is in a different place in its product plan. For example, Ford has been more rapid in moving towards smaller vehicles. Last week, it shut down its massive SUV plant in Michigan to start retooling it to build small cars based on a European design. GM and Chrysler have been a little bit behind Ford in those kinds of efforts. I think there's some concern from the Detroit side that they're already under a lot of strain in their businesses. Trying to meet a higher bar on fuel economy standards would only add to that strain. On the other hand, here in D.C., you have a lot of members of Congress who want to see Detroit make a stronger pledge towards more fuel-efficient vehicles.
And is there a different attitude now, 2 weeks later, on the Washington side?
There's a lot of consensus that they're in dire straits and that without some sort of government aid, one or more of them might collapse. But there's not a lot of agreement on how the government should help them and what pool of money should be used to grant the automakers these loans. Congressional Democrats have one idea. Republicans have another. The White House has another. And unless that gets resolved. It seems very hard for a consensus to form that would get a bill through in the short time that's available.
And again, the hearings will take place Thursday and Friday?
The Senate committee will hear them on Thursday. The House committee will hear them on Friday. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said Congress could come back next Monday to consider a bill if they see enough momentum behind the aid in order to make that feasible. That does not leave a lot of time for the automakers to convince a lot of skeptical lawmakers that they're worth saving or that they're worth having these loans.
Justin Hyde covers the auto industry for the Detroit Free Press. Justin, thank you.
Thank you, Madam.
We've heard a lot about the hundreds of thousands of people that could lose their current jobs if the big three automakers collapse. But there are nearly as many people already retired who count on GM, Chrysler, and Ford for their pensions and their health care coverage. NPR's Celeste Headlee reports.
For retirees from the big three, these are scary times.
People are afraid. There's no two ways about it.
Michelle Krebs is editor of EdmondsAutoObserver.com. She says there are perhaps tens of thousands, maybe more, who've taken voluntary early retirement packages from the domestic automakers.
And that number is continuing to increase because every day there are new buyouts being offered.
Over the past few years, automakers have slashed their workforce dramatically, partly through early retirement for people who had put in 30 years or more. But Don Grimes of the University of Michigan says retirees under the age of 65 will see their pensions cut dramatically if the big three go under, and they won't be eligible for Medicare either.
That means that people are going to have to be shelling out $4,000 or $5,000 a year to pay for their health insurance benefits.
Grimes says it will be disastrous for the already struggling Midwest states.
And it would be a catastrophe in Florida as well, where a lot of the retirees have moved.
Frank Gedeke worked for 30 years at General Motors in Michigan before taking early retirement this year.
I can't go back and relive these 30 years that I've put in with the company.
Gedeke says he's afraid that he may never collect the pension that he spent decades earning.
The whole state is worried because everybody in the whole state knows somebody that's going to be affected by it or would be affected by this.
He says he's looking for work, but it's not easy.
I'm just hoping that in Michigan, with 9.3% unemployment, that I can find another job.
Gedeke was a member of the UAW, but non-union auto workers are feeling it too. Paul Bardis is in his 50s. He worked for Ford as a powertrain engineer for 20 years. He took early retirement last year. Bardis says he understands the fear of his fellow retirees.
I share their concern, but, you know, in my personal situation, what are we going to do, worry about it? We're going to take one day at a time.
Bardis says he's infuriated over the national debate that's raging about whether or not to offer bridge loans to the big three.
Why don't Americans care from coast to coast about other Americans?
He says most people probably don't appreciate the scope of the problem and seem insensitive to the plight of the auto workers, the retirees, their children, and their grandchildren.
Are we doing that because we were jealous because they had good benefits, they had good retirements? Is that the reason why people feel the way they do?
Bardis took a job at a Japanese parts supplier for a while, and now he's back in the market, hoping to find work to supplement his pension or replace it if necessary. Michelle Krebs of Edmonds Auto Observer says there will soon be tens of thousands of people trying to return to work.
These are people who are going to be in the job market. The big question is, where are the jobs?
Krebs says they won't all find jobs with the foreign automakers, who are also struggling, and even markets overseas, like Brazil and China, are in tough shape.
They don't have a different geography to go to, and they don't necessarily have a different industry to go to.
Krebs says it'll cost the government billions to absorb retirement benefits for former auto workers and much more for health care.
Taxpayers will pay one way or another. They can pay up front the bridge loans that hopefully will make it a little more orderly, or the car companies fold and it is chaos.
Don Grimes of the University of Michigan says the stakes are high, and that's why current auto workers must be ready to make concessions in order to get the big three back on track.
If they don't make every effort and give up anything to get these companies to continue in business, the retirees are going to lose tens of thousands of dollars a year in benefits if they're under 65.
Grimes says there will almost certainly be new contract negotiations that accompany federal aid, and he has a message for current auto workers.
The cost for everybody concerned could be catastrophic. So think very carefully on what you're doing and look at it with a clear and open mind.
He says the current economic crisis is already sparking a national debate over banking regulation and health care. Now you can add pensions into the mix. Celeste Headley, NPR News, Detroit.
Let's look at the political future of Iraq's current Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki. After Iraq signed a security agreement with the United States last week, some Iraqi analysts worry that Maliki's power may become too great. Juan Cole is a professor of modern Middle East history at the University of Michigan, and he blogs about foreign affairs, especially Iraq. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, are you one of those who are worried that Nouri al-Maliki might get too much power and become another dictator?
Well, it would be a startling reversal of fortunes if true. Iraq has suffered from lack of a government since 2003. Al-Maliki seems to have gotten control at last of the military, and he has been deploying it in places like Basra and Amara, Sadr City, with some effectiveness, and that has raised these questions. I think that the prime minister can ask the army to do something and that it does it is in itself so worrisome as a good sign.
Well, given the fact that Iraq is in the middle of a war and is fighting extremist forces, doesn't Maliki need to have a strong hand with the military?
He is trying to impose central government rule on a country that hasn't had it since Saddam fell and which resents it, doesn't want it, and which is fighting back against him. But to that extent, you know, there are trade-offs. There's less freedom, but more order. And in a place like Basra, for instance, they'd suffered from militia rule.
And I guess is the worry that once calm is restored, if it is restored, there is more order, that Maliki won't back off in having a strong hand with the military.
Right. The question is, how far will he go? He has also established his own militias, tribal militias, which are loyal to him personally, and that's the thing that I think has most worried people.
This new agreement calls for the withdrawal of U.S. troops by 2011. Is there a valid fear that once U.S. troops leave, that the country will dissolve into civil war?
I would argue that the country has been fighting several civil wars while the U.S. troops have been there. Baghdad, for instance, has witnessed a major demographic battle between the Sunnis and the Shiites, which the Shiites won last year fairly decisively. I think Baghdad is now 75-80% Shiite. It had been about 50-50 when the U.S. first came. And this happened under the nose of the U.S. troops. There was nothing they could do about it. It happened at a micro level in neighborhoods and so forth. But the kinds of struggles that are likely to happen are ones in which the U.S. would have had difficulty intervening in any case, and would be like the struggle in Baghdad in which they were unable to stop the ethnic cleansing.
What are the implications for the United States if Nouri al-Maliki does become a strong dictator in Iraq? Are these necessarily bad implications for the United States?
Well, for Iraq to have a relatively strong central government is not a bad thing for the United States. Al-Maliki, so far, has been favorable to the United States in his policies. What the U.S. will want from Iraq as it withdraws is that it not be a wholly owned subsidiary of the Ayatollahs in Iran, but al-Maliki's Islamic Mission Party, the Dawah Party, is an Iraqi homegrown lay party. It's not a clerical party, and the kind of government that al-Maliki is establishing, were it to assert itself in Iraq, has certain virtues for the United States. It's not what the Bush administration had been going for. It's not a secular state. It's not. It is a Shiite fundamentalist state.
Not a beacon of democracy in the Middle East.
The problem is that as Iraq has evolved, there are three ethnic blocs: the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Kurds. People so far in Iraq have been unwilling to vote across those boundaries in any large numbers, and they have scorned secular parties. So if that's the way politics is going to happen in Iraq, even if you have regular elections, even if you have what we would think of as democratic procedures, then the Shiite majority of 60% is always going to assert itself. And al-Maliki has been able to make use of that.
Juan Cole is a professor of modern Middle East history at the University of Michigan and author of the forthcoming book, Engaging the Muslim World. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. We go now to Bangkok, Thailand, where more anti-government demonstrators went to the capital's two main airports today. These demonstrators have been occupying the airports to try to force the current democratically elected government to resign. These protesters are well-armed in case they're assaulted by police. But as NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from the international airport, these demonstrators don't seem too worried about the threat of violence.
This doesn't feel like an occupation. This feels more like a carnival. There are thousands of people gathered here outside the terminal at Bangkok Suvarnabhumi International Airport. I'm standing outside the Thai Airways Royal First and Royal Silk entrance. This is entrance number one here. And there are people lined up to get free food that's been provided by the organizers. There's lots of free drink here. There's a bunch of people over to my left here taking advantage of free clothing that's being handed out here. Let me see what they have. They have shirts. They have some blankets for when it gets a little colder a little later. Oh, they even have some underwear for people who've been here for a few days and want some clean underwear. They have that here, too. And the people here seem to be jubilant. I see more cars arriving here all the time. And this despite the fact that the police have been ordered by the government, by the prime minister, to shut this thing down. Now, what they're after is to get the government and the prime minister, the current government and prime minister, to resign. But let's go find someone and ask them specifically why they feel this way. Hi.
Hi.
I'm Michael.
Yeah, my name is Gina.
Gina, what are you doing here?
Me? I want to show up that how it's Thai people to protest with against the government.
But this is an illegal occupation of the international airport. And it's an embarrassment for Thailand in the eyes of the world, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. But I know this is embarrassed, but we believe that it should be like a short term, just five, six, or seven days, and then clear cut everything. It should not be long. Should not take long.
It should not take long, but if the prime minister does not resign and the PAD refuses to leave here, then...
I believe something gonna happen.
When you say something's going to happen, do you mean you think that the police are going to try to intervene?
Could be, but I think something going to happen is like miracle. We cannot stay DC for long, otherwise it's going to ruin the Thailand reputation, right?
And the economy.
Yeah, the economy.
You say you're expecting a miracle. What kind of miracle?
Maybe power of somebody can stop something. Maybe that time is something like a violence happened. If some violence happened, I believe that some power of somebody. I can say just only this.
But you're not worried about the police coming in and forcibly dispersing you here?
I know how to escape. I know how to escape. If they come.
All right, well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Well, there's one person who says that if the police do come and use force, she's going to find a way out of here. There are many other people who insist that they will stay here and they will fight until they are dead. This is what you're hearing here from a lot of the protest leaders, and this is what you're hearing from a lot of the protesters who are sitting here.
NPR's Michael Sullivan wandering the terminal at Bangkok's International Airport. This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Madeline Brand. Saddam Hussein was president of Iraq for 24 years. He was executed 2 years ago. Millions of people watched the life of Saddam Hussein as it played out in the news. Now his story will be told in an HBO film. It's called House of Saddam. It's a four-part series, and it begins this weekend.
House of Saddam was written and directed by Alex Holmes, who joins us now from the BBC studios in London. And here at NPR West, we are joined by Shohreh Aghdashloo. She plays Saddam Hussein's wife, his first wife. Welcome both.
Thank you so much. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Having
it's
us.
It's great to be here.
Alex, this film portrays Saddam Hussein almost as if he's Tony Soprano. He's just absolutely ruthless. He's incredibly violent. And in one of the earlier scenes in the film, you see him kill one of his closest friends. It's shocking. And he provides this explanation for his actions.
The man who can sacrifice even his best friend is a man without weakness. In the eyes of my enemies, I am stronger now.
Alex Holmes, you did extensive research for this film. How did that research shape your ideas of who this man was?
Well, I think I was struck very early on by how closely the family relationships within Saddam's inner circle mapped onto the political relationships. Obviously, I had followed the modern history of Iraq to a certain extent because of the West's involvement in it. But I was really surprised when I started reading in detail about Saddam, about just how closely the family and politics overlapped. And in a way, you compared our portrayal to Tony Soprano. Well, in a way, it struck me that there was something of a mafia quality to the way this inner circle was run.
Shoa, you play Saddam Hussein's first wife, and the two of you in real life were set up in an arranged marriage. What about this role appeal to you?
Well, it's although a controversial role, but it was pretty challenging. I'd never played a character who was still alive, especially a woman at her level, with her caliber. It is just amazing how stubborn and how she was, after all, Saddam's cousin. So more or less, she was like Saddam, stubborn, hard-headed, and confused.
Let's take a listen to a scene from House of Saddam, and this is a scene where your brother Adnan, who was also a close friend of Saddam Hussein's and his minister of defense, has died in what's called a helicopter accident, but you, as his wife, you know that it was your husband, in fact, who was responsible.
Adnan was your friend. He loved you, and you needed him. Now look what you're left with. Men who are nothing but afraid of you.
Adnan was killed in a tragic accident. I'm sorry.
Accidents do not happen in Iraq anymore.
Sajida, go shopping.
For you personally, how did you tap into the emotions that were going on in that scene?
Well, it was very hard. I have three brothers and I love them all. Obviously, I try not to think about it when I'm acting, but I was just thinking that if anybody does anything to my brother, I would kill him. This is the end for this woman, for Sajida Khairullah. That's how I felt.
Alex, so much of this film shows how Saddam Hussein ruled by fear, and there were so many examples of that. How did you choose the ones to include in this miniseries?
Task, I think, was to really shed light on the character of Saddam and how that character influenced the turn of events and the turn of politics. So I think that I wanted to find those events in the course of history that had demonstrated how Saddam had this failure to trust, which I think was in some ways his central flaw.
Was there any point that either of you felt some sense of sympathy for him as a human, despite all of the terrible things he had done?
I'm afraid there was. I don't know with Alex, but with me, yes, there was, especially when I started reading the book. At one point when I was reading about his childhood with his stepfather, Hassan the Liar, who used to beat him every morning, waking up and sending him to steal from the neighbors and bring the food home, I really felt sorry for him. I thought if he was born into a good, respectable family, he would probably be a great doctor or a great lawyer. He was extremely smart.
Alex, what about you?
Well, I think when you write a character dramatically like this, you have to find the humanity within them in order to properly understand why it is they did what they did and why they did it in that particular way. So there were times when I felt very close to Saddam. It's a strange thing to be in the mindset of someone who had done so many terrible things. But I think that I was also interested in exploring how his great dream for what Iraq could have been, came to dust in his hands, and what it was about his character that turned what was in fact a very strong and powerful vision for Iraq as a leading light in the region, how that turned into a nightmare. And I think in order to do that, you had to understand that he was a man who was capable of thinking great things as well as carrying out terrible things.
Shorey, before you moved to Hollywood, you grew up in Iran, and I'm curious if there was anything about your own personal experience and background that you were able to bring to this role playing Saddam Hussein's wife.
The only thing that I tried to take benefit from was the fact that I was a Middle Easterner, and women are different, you know, they are warm-blooded, and when they get angry, they really get angry. So I was trying to remember how they used to get angry back in Iran, you know, women, you know, my aunts or my, you know, family members, female family members.
But I think your appreciation, Shorey, of what it's like to be a woman in that culture was really significant in the way in which we were able to bring that world to the screen, because it would be wrong to think that women are without power in that culture. They just have to find their own particular ways of exercising it.
Yes, it's a rumor that women don't have power in the Middle East. They do, and it's through the pillow talks that they run all the wars in the Middle East.
Alex Holmes, this film, House of Saddam, focuses in large part on Saddam Hussein's family. Can you give us an update? Where are they now, and did you ever have an opportunity to speak with any of them?
Well, we did try and speak with them, and indeed messages were passed via intermediaries, including, in fact, with Saddam himself when he was in captivity. However, I think they weren't particularly interested in assisting us in making this project, perhaps unsurprisingly. As to where they are now, the family is scattered to the four corners of the Middle East, I understand. Obviously, I haven't heard from them or been in touch with them myself, but, you know, I think they are trying to keep a relatively low profile.
Alex, have you played this at all for Iraqi audiences, and how do they respond to what is basically a dramatic interpretation of their real history?
Well, this series has been broadcast by the BBC in the United Kingdom, and through that channel, a lot of Iraqis have actually seen the series, and I was been greatly flattered, really, by their response, which has been to say that they found it fascinating, and that it took them to areas of their own history that they weren't always completely familiar with, and they felt it was a fascinating personal portrayal of a man who they often had very ambivalent feelings towards, and I think that they felt that the series captured that ambivalence, the greatness and the tragedy of the man. So I was very pleased that they saw it in that light.
Alex Holmes wrote and directed the HBO miniseries House of Saddam. Shorey Agdashloo stars in the film. Thanks very much to you both.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having us.
Back now with Day to Day.
With the shopping season underway, reports and photos streamed in over the weekend depicting a nation defined not so much by its holiday spirit, but by the lengths it will go to save $100 on a high-def TV.
It's our humorist Brian Unger with today's Unger Report.
Long before one crosses the threshold into the zone of super spectacular bonanza-like savings of midnight madness, holiday bargain blowouts, everything must go, don't miss it, war zone of fiduciary delight, festival of borrowing and bankruptcy, orgy of ugly sale, the trouble begins in the parking lot, as shoppers compete to park as close to a bargain as possible, trading furious, hateful stares. If we could only drive our cars inside the stores and park in the aisles, now that would be something. But until that day comes, we creep along the asphalt jungle floor, stalking our prey, the parking space, looking for a spot to nest. No, we're a cheetah, stealthily hunting a wildebeest on the Serengeti. We spy something walking upright ahead and glide, pulling our car up so close behind on the hooves as not to be threatening, but as to say, I am so taking your spot when you leave. he or she stops at their car, great space, opens the hatchback, and signals to us with a shake of a head and says, "I'm just putting my bags away. I'm not going anywhere, buddy." The way we stalk people in parking lots would be, in any other setting, harassment. All in an effort to avoid walking a tenth of a mile to enter into a mall, where once inside, we will walk a mile and stand for hours. We'll even say the darndest things to each other, like, "That's my parking spot, you
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
We cannot allow holiday shopping to become an extreme sport. So please, when you go shopping, leave your guns at home. Roll, duck, or cover should not be on anyone's shopping list this year. Right now, our nation is being measured by its value, not by its values. But while we stimulate the economy, stave off foreclosure, secure financing, score savings, search for bargains, wait in lines, layaway, add, subtract, and multiply, we are most of all the sum of our humanity and dignity. Also, leave your Kevlar vest at home. It'll make trying on clothes a lot easier. And that is today's Unger Report. Happy shopping. I'm Brian Unger.
Finally today, a trend called sleeve face. The sleeve here refers to an album sleeve or cover. When you hold it up to your face and take a photo, you make sleeve face. Carl Morris is a DJ living in Cardiff, Wales, and one of the authors of a new book called Sleeve Face, Be the Vinyl. He told me the phenomenon started as a bit of a fluke.
Sleeve face was born when I was just messing around, really, horsing around. I picked up a record which happened to have Paul McCartney's face on the cover, and I held it in front of my face, so my face was hidden, and Paul McCartney, his head was sort of magically grafted onto my neck. And a friend of mine took a photo of that, and we thought that that would be quite a fun use of time, really. So we've been going through our record collections and discovering different records that we could use, and started a website called sleeveface.com.
It's really been taking off. You've got this book and you've got the website, sleeveface.com. What are some of the best ones that you've seen so far?
Somebody's in California, actually, has done one with a Carpenters album that involves a picture of a car. The album's called Now and Then by the Carpenters, and they've matched it up with a car. It looks pretty special.
There's a bit of an art to all of this. You've created an instructional video explaining it. Could you give me some of the basic rules of how to sleeve face?
One thing that sort of emerged naturally as a bit of a rule that we follow is that we never tweak the images, and we never use Photoshop or any software to change the images in any way. But other than that, there's a lot of versatility and experimentation, and I dare not set any rules, really, because if I tried to set some rules, then somebody would probably break them and create something new and interesting.
I think there's a one in your book. It's the cover for the soundtrack of Hair, and then the person who sleeve-faced it is then holding, for some reason unknown to me, a giant, brightly colored plastic water gun.
Yes. I mean, there probably isn't a reason. It's just whatever was available to hand. And that's part of it, is the happy accidents as much as the planning. Just make it look interesting, and you can sort of deduce little things about these people, even though you can't actually see their faces.
Some of the ones that you see are ones where people basically dress up in such a way that you'd see what the rest of the album cover might look like if it extended beyond. But some of my favorites are the ones that just use contrast to make things humorous. There's an example, page 11 in your book. It's Barbara Streisand's Greatest Hits, Volume 2. It shows her head in profile, and someone has sleeve-faced it with their dog. So you've got Barbara Streisand's head on a black Labrador, I believe. And a similar one, there's Gil Scott-Heron and his album The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. And the album cover's got this really serious shot of his face. And then the person who sleeve-faced it is wearing these pink Hello Kitty socks, which kind of makes the whole thing look ridiculous. What do you think are some of the tricks that you can employ to make the best sleeve-face shots?
Costume is certainly one that we've embraced, where if the artist on the sleeve has got a black T-shirt, then if you wear a black T-shirt, it will help to reinforce the illusion and make the illusion more believable. People have been using props as well. For instance, Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel has got the two of them standing there. But if you hold that directly in front of your face, it's very difficult to make it look believable. So you need to get a photographer and then another friend to hold the sleeve at a distance, and then the perspective will help, you know, to have it lined up and believable.
Carl Morris is a DJ and the man behind Sleeve Face, the book and website. Thanks so much, Carl.
Yeah, thanks, Alex.
If you'd like to see how we here at NPR West fared when we took our own Sleeve Face photos, or if you'd like to send us one of your own, go to our blog. It's npr.org/daydreaming. Like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay.
Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen.